Kettles signaled the engine room, and their wild descent began to slow. A few measured breaths later, Predator leveled out, and they simply waited, everyone on deck entirely silent, while Kettle struggled to trim the wounded ship as she completed her dash. After a time, Grimm slowly exhaled and bowed his head. He reached up and wearily removed his goggles. The wet air felt cold and sticky against the skin around his eyes.
"They aren't chasing us,"
Creedy breathed, bringing his own goggles down.
"Course not. Itasca's too damn big,"
Grimm replied. His voice sounded hoarse and thin in his own ears. His neck and shoulders felt as if they'd been replaced with bars of brass.
"A monster like that can't dive with Predator. Besides, no Auroran captain would try to follow us in this murk for fear of looking ridiculous. Two blind men can't have a very dignified chase."
Creedy snorted through his nose.
"Damage control,"
Grimm said quietly, unfastening his safety lines.
"Make sure Dr. Bacon has everything he needs to see to the wounded. Call the roll. I'll be in my cabin."
Creedy nodded, looking slowly around them.
"Sir?"
Grimm paused.
"This ship's shroud. It's extremely powerful for a vessel of this size."
The young officer hadn't actually asked the question, but it hung unspoken in the air between them. Grimm didn't like prevarication. It complicated life. But though he thought the young officer was a decent enough sort, he wasn't ready to extend that much trust. Not yet. So he gave the XO a flat gaze and said,
"See to the ship, if you please, Mr. Creedy."
Creedy snapped to attention and threw him an academy-perfect salute.
"Yes, sir, Captain."
Grimm turned and went to the privacy of his cabin. He closed the door behind him and sat down on his bunk. The battle was over. His hands started to shake, and then his arms, and then his belly. He curled his chest up to his knees and sat quietly for a moment, shuddering in the terror and excitement he hadn't allowed himself to feel during the engagement. Erickson's scream echoed in Grimm's head. He closed his eyes, and the purple blotch the dying number 3 gun had burned on his retina hovered in his darkened vision.
Stupid.
He'd been stupid. He'd been tearing huge swaths of profit from the Auroran merchant fleet. It had been inevitable that they would eventually respond to him. Some idiot would probably say that the fact that they'd sent Itasca to deal with him was a high compliment. Said idiot wouldn't be visiting the families of the dead men to give them his condolences and their death pay. He knew that he'd made sound decisions, given what he'd known at the time, but some of his men were dead because of them nonetheless. They were dead because he'd commanded them, and they'd followed. They'd known the risks, to a man, and every one of them was ex-fleet. Things could have gone immeasurably worse than they had, but that would be little comfort to the newly minted widows back at the home spire. He sat and shuddered and regretted and promised dead men's shades that he wouldn't make the same mistake twice. He was the captain. By the time Creedy arrived with the damage report, Grimm had reassembled himself.
"Captain,"
Creedy said respectfully,
"I don't think your accomplishments have been properly appreciated at home."
"Oh?"
Grimm asked.
"Yes, sir,"
Creedy said. Controlled admiration crept into his tone.
"I mean, for the Aurorans to dispatch Itasca to mousetrap a lone privateer. When you think about it, it's really a kind of compliment, sir."
Grimm sighed. "Captain Castillo is one of their best," Creedy went on.
"His attack was nearly perfect, but you slipped right through his fingers. If you were a captain in the fleet, you'd have merited tactical honors for..."
Creedy's face reddened and his voice trailed off.
There are worse things to happen to a man than being drummed out of the fleet, XO,
Grimm said quietly.
Casualties, then damage reports. How bad?
Bad enough, Creedy said. 5 dead, 6 injured, shrapnel, mostly, and a concussion from an aeronaut in engineering who unhooked his second line too soon.
Grimm nodded. The ship?
The dorsal masts are stubs. We'll need to get to a yard to replace them. We had to cut the rigging loose and drop it, so we lost most of the dorsal web. And there's a hole in the gun deck where the number 3 gun was. We'll need a yard to repair that, too. And we blew 2 cables in our suspension rig.
Grimm took a slow breath. The suspension rig was the central structure of the ship, built around the main lift crystal. The weight of the entire ship hung suspended from the rig and was distributed through its cables. There were 8 of them, any 2 enough to bear the weight of the entire vessel. But the more cables broke, the more likely it was that those remaining would break, especially during any high-speed maneuvers. The loss of the occasional cable was expected, but was never to be taken lightly.
You're saving the best for last, I think,
Grimm said.
Creedy grimaced.
Chief Journeyman says there are fractures in the main lift crystal.
Grimm stopped himself from spitting an acid curse and closed his eyes. That second dive, so soon after the first.
That was his theory, sir. He's cut power to the lift crystal and is running extra to the trim crystals to make up the difference in buoyancy and keep us afloat.
Grimm smiled faintly and opened his eyes. There will be no prize money on this trip, and no bounty either. The trim crystals that helped adjust the ship's attitude were expensive, and using them to help maintain the ship's lift would be hard on them. But replacing them was a standard operating cost. The large crystals, sufficiently powerful to suspend airships, were another matter. They were far rarer and much more bitterly expensive.
Only a power core cost more, assuming one could be found at all. Where would he get the money?
I see,
Grimm said.
We'll simply have to replace it, I suppose.
Perhaps Fleet will put in a word with the Lancasters.
Creedy gave him a smile that contained more artifice than agreement.
Yes, sir.
Well, Grimm said, it seems we need to return home. A bit earlier than we'd planned, but that's all right.
Set course for Spire Albion, sir.
We're in the mist, XO,
Grimm replied.
We can't take our bearings until we get back up into open sky, where Itasca is doubtless hunting for us.
A low groaning tone rumbled through the cabin's portal. After several seconds it rose higher and higher and higher, into a kind of distorted whistle, and then faded away. Creedy stared out the portal and licked his lips.
Sir, was that...
Mistmore,
Grimm replied quietly.
Yes.
Isn't that a danger to the ship, sir?
Swallow us whole,
Grimm agreed.
They aren't usually aggressive this time of year.
Usually?
Grimm shrugged.
If it decides to come eat us, we can't stop it, XO. Our pop guns will only make it angry.
The beasts are that big?
Grimm found himself smiling.
They're that big.
He inhaled and exhaled slowly.
And they're attracted to powered webbing.
Creedy glanced out the portal again. Perhaps we should cut power to the web and reel it in, sir.
I think that would be very wise, XO,
Grimm said.
Though I expect Journeyman cut power to the web within a moment after we pulled out of the dive. Unfurl the sails. We'll spend the night moving with the wind, come up sometime tomorrow, and trust that Itasca won't be sitting there waiting for us.
Creedy nodded. Once again the strange, long call of the sounding Mistmore vibrated through the cabin.
Sir, what do we do about that?
The only thing we can, Exo,
Grim said.
We stay very, very quiet.
He nodded a dismissal to Creedy and said,
Raise sail. The sooner we get moving, the sooner we get back to Spire Albion.
Chapter 3 Spire Albion, Havel Morning, Targwyn Vattery. Bridget sat in the dim vaults of the Vattery, back in the shadowy corner where the cracked old vat had been removed. She wedged her back against the corner and held her knees up close to her chest. She was cold, of course. The chamber was always cold. She noticed only when she paused to think about it. She'd lived too much of her life in this room for it to be truly uncomfortable.
Bridget, called her father's deep voice from the entrance of the chamber. Bridget, are you back here? It's time.
Bridget hugged herself harder and pushed a little farther back into the corner. The rows and rows of vats scattered the sound of his voice, sending it bouncing around the chamber. She leaned her head against the cold, reassuring solidity of the cinderstone wall and closed her eyes. This was her home. She didn't want to leave her home. Her father's voice, gentle and deep, came again.
Take a few more moments, child, and then I want you to come out, please.
She didn't answer him. She heard his gentle sigh. She heard the doors to the chambers shut, leaving her with the quietly gurgling vats and the faint glow of a few scattered second-hand lumen crystals. It wasn't fair. She was perfectly happy doing exactly what she'd done ever since she was a small child, and it was a good and necessary duty. Her father's vats provided the finest meats in all of Havel Morning, after all. Without someone to tend them, people would starve, or at least eat inferior meat, she supposed. Personally, she took pride in her craft. She'd rather starve to death, if necessary, than eat that ridiculous rubbery chum that Camden's Vattery produced. It was ridiculous. Her family wasn't one of the high houses, except in a fussy technical sense. She and her father were the only remaining members of the Targwyn line, for goodness sake. And it wasn't as though they were running out buying new ether silk outfits every other week. Or at all. They lived no better than anyone else in Havel Morning. She hadn't asked to be born to the lineage of some overachieving, bloodthirsty fleet admiral, no matter how respected a role he played in the history of Spire Albion. It wasn't as though she and her father enjoyed any particular privileges. Why on earth should she submit to an outdated, rigidly traditional obligation? She felt a small surge of outrage and tried to ride it into something larger and more determined, but it dwindled and flickered out again, leaving her feeling small. She could pretend all she liked. She knew the real reason she didn't want to spend her year in the service of the Spire Arc. She was afraid. There was a rustle and a very light thump. Then she looked up to see one of her favorite people bound lightly from the top of the next vat, land in silence only a few feet away, and sit down, regarding her with large green eyes.
"Good morning, Raoul,"
she said. Her voice sounded little and squeaky in her own ears, especially compared to her father's basso rumble. The dark ginger cat purred a greeting and padded over to her. Without preamble, he climbed into her lap, turned a lazy, imperious circle, and settled down, still purring throatily. Bridget smiled and began to run her fingers lightly around the bases of Raoul's ears. His purr deepened, and his eyes narrowed to green slits.
"I don't want to go," she said. "It isn't fair. And it isn't as though I can actually help anyone with anything. All I know is the Vattery."
Raoul's purring continued.
"We don't even own a gauntlet or a sword, unless you count our carving knives. We don't have enough money to get them either. And even if we did, I don't have the faintest idea of how to use them. What am I supposed to do for the Spire Arc's guard? Raoul, having had his fill of getting his ears rubbed, stretched and turned over onto his back. When she didn't begin immediately, he swatted lightly at her hand with a soft paw until she started scratching his chest and belly. Then he sprawled in unashamed luxury, enjoying the attention.
"But you know, Father, he's so good about honouring his obligations. When he gives his word, he keeps it. When he sets out to accomplish something, it's not enough simply to accomplish it. He needs to be the best at it, too, or at least try to be. He served his time. He says it's important for me to do it, too."
She sighed.
"But it's a whole year. I won't get to see him at all. And the neighbours, and the people in this corridor, and the vats, and the shop, and—"
She bowed her head and felt her face twist up in pure misery. She gathered Raoul in her arms and hugged him to her, rocking back and forth slightly. After a few moments, the cat murmured,
"A little mouse, you're squishing my fur."
Bridget jerked guiltily and sat up, loosening her embrace.
"Oh," she apologized. "Please excuse me."
The cat turned to meet her eyes with his and seemed to consider that for a moment. Then he nodded and said,
"I do."
"Thank you,"
Bridget said.
"You are welcome."
The cat flicked his tail back and forth a few times and said,
"Word Keeper wishes you to leave his territory."
"It isn't that he wants me to go," Bridget said. "He thinks it's important that I do so."
Raoul tilted his head.
"Then it is a duty."
"That's how he sees it," Bridget said.
"Then there is no matter for consideration,"
the cat replied.
"You have a duty to your sire. He has a duty to his chief. If he has agreed to loan one of his warriors to his chief, then that warrior should go."
"But I'm not a warrior,"
Bridget said. The cat looked at her for a moment and then leaned his head forward to rub his little whiskery muzzle against her face.
"There are many kinds of war, little mouse."
"What's that supposed to mean?" she asked.
"That you are young,"
the cat said,
"and less wise than one who is old. I am wiser than you, and I say you should go. It is obvious. You should trust a wiser head than your own."
"You aren't any older than I am,"
she countered.
"I am cat,"
Raoul said smugly,
"which means I have made better use of my time."
"Oh, you're impossible," Bridget said.
"Yes, cat."
Raoul rose and flowed down onto the floor. He turned to face her, curling his tail around his paws.
"Why do you wish to dishonor and humiliate Wordkeeper? Would you change his name?"
"No, of course not," Bridget said. "But I'm not like him."
"No," Raoul said. "That is what growing up is for."
"I am not a child," she said.
The cat looked around speculatively and then turned back to her.
"Rather than do your duty, you are hiding in the darkest corner of the darkest room in your home. This is very wise, very mature."
Bridget scowled and folded her arms over her stomach, but she said nothing. She was acting like a child. Raoul was right. He generally was, but did he have to be so irritating about it?
"You are afraid,"
Raoul said.
"You are afraid to leave the territory you know."
Bridget felt the tears welling up again. She nodded.
"Why?"
Raoul asked.
"What is there to fear?"
"I don't know," she whispered.
Raoul just sat, green eyes penetrating. Bridget bit her lip. Then she said in a very small voice,
I don't want to be alone.
Ah,
Raoul said. The cat turned and vanished into the deep shadows of the chamber, leaving her feeling smaller and colder and even more alone than before. Bridget wiped out her eyes with her sleeve and swallowed the tight feeling in her throat. Then she stood up. She left her hand against the cool stone for another long moment and tried to think of that familiar sensation coursing into her, infusing her with strength. Raoul was right in his smugly annoying way. Her family did have a duty. There might not be much left of House Targwyn, but it was still a good house. After all her father had done for her, after all the love he had given her when her mother passed, she owed him more than embarrassment, even if no one thought it embarrassing but him. It was only a year, only one long, strange, lonely, terrifying year. She walked slowly to the chamber door. When her father opened it, she looked up at him. Franklin Tarquin was an enormous block of a man, his shoulders almost as wide as the doorway. His arms were thicker than many men's legs, and the muscles sloping up to his columnar neck were like slabs of stone. He wore his white apron and his belt with its vatterist's carving knives. His rumpled hair was the colour of bare iron, and his eyes looked tired and concerned. She tried to smile for him. He deserved it. His answering smile was tired, and she knew she hadn't fooled him. He didn't say anything. He just enfolded her in a gentle hug. She put her arms around his solid warmth and leaned against him.
There's my brave girl, he said quietly. My Bridget. Your mother would have been so proud of you.
I'm not brave, she said. I'm so afraid.
I know, he said.
I won't know anyone, she said.
I expect you'll make friends quickly enough. I did.
She huffed out a tired little breath.
Because I've made so many friends in the houses already.
Bridget, he said, his voice a gentle reproof. You know you've never really tried.
Of course not. They're pompous, spoiled, egotistical brats.
His chuckle was a low rumble against her cheek.
Yes, I know that they seem that way to you. But you had more responsibility thrust on you than most children when you were young, especially the children of the houses. You had to grow up so fast.
He leaned his cheek against her hair.
I can hardly believe it myself. 17 years went by so quickly.
Daddy,
she said quietly. I know you haven't cared much for the other children of the houses, but they aren't all bad, and most of them will grow up, eventually. You'll see.
He leaned back from her and held her at arm's length.
There's something I must speak to you about. One more responsibility I must ask of you.
She nodded.
Of course, Father.
He rested his huge hand fondly on her head for a moment, smiling. Then he said,
I need you to look after someone for me.
She tilted her head and blinked. Pardon? Behind her father, two cats sauntered into the room. The first was a very large grey male, a muscular beast with many scars in his otherwise smooth fur and notched ears. The second was Raoul. The ginger cat sat down behind and slightly to one side of the grey, and his whiskers quivered with amusement. His father spoke very seriously.
Clan Chief Maul has decided that it is time for the Spireark to recognize his tribe as citizens of Habble Morning, which, to his way of thinking, obviously means that his line is no different from one of the other high houses. As such, he acknowledges his obligation to detach a member of his family for service to the Spireark. I offered you to Raoul as a guide, to help him learn the ways of the Spireark's warriors.
Bridget blinked for a moment, and then felt her face turning up into a wide, wide smile.
Wait, are you saying that
Raoul is going with me.
No,
Raoul said smugly.
You are going with me. It is much more important that way.
Chief Maul glanced at Raoul in what might have been vague disapproval. The younger cat blinked his eyes once, slowly, and seemed to Bridget to be insufferably pleased with himself.
This is an important duty, her father said.
Laughter sparkled in his eyes, and I know it will be a sacrifice for you. But are you willing to do this for the sake of House Tarquin's good relations with the chief and his clan? Bridget turned to Raoul and held out her arms. The ginger cat padded over and leapt up into them, nuzzled his cheek against hers again, and settled down comfortably. His softness was a favourite blanket, and his purr was as familiar as one of her mother's barely remembered lullabies.
Well,
Bridget said. She nuzzled her cheek against Raoul's fur.
If it's for the House of Tagman, then obviously it is my solemn duty. I'll manage.
Chapter 4 Spire Albion, Habel Morning. For Gwen, the following 2 weeks were absolutely dreadful.
I really don't quite see the point of all this, she panted.
Her legs hurt, her feet ached, her chest felt as if it were on fire. All in all, she saw little reason for this running about the Spire Arch's manor, and they'd done so for increasing amounts of time every single day during their training.
It's good for you,
Cousin Benedict said. He was a tall, lean young man, less than 2 years older than Gwen herself, with tawny brown hair cut into a soft, thick brush. He wore the same exercise uniform Gwen did, though he loped along beside her lightly, without any apparent effort at all. There was no detectable strain in his voice, none at all. The rotten, cat-eyed, thoroughly disgusting lout.
It's all very well for you, Gwen gasped. You've done it before.
For the last 2 years, yes,
Benedict agreed.
You aren't wearing these ridiculous clothes.
I'm wearing exactly the same clothing, Benedict countered.
Yes, but you're used to them. Ugh, pants. How do you stand running in these things?
Better than I would in skirts, I dare say, he answered. I thought you'd love the running, Gwen. I personally grew to find it invigorating. Gwen sputtered.
Invigorating? Benedict Michael Sorrelin Lancaster, you may personally kiss my...
As you wish, cuz, Benedict said, smiling. I must say, you're shaping up rather nicely.
Gwen kept pushing herself to keep moving, and felt that she hardly had the energy to regard the compliment with the proper suspicion.
What?
The tall young man smirked. You were barely able to complain at all the first few days. Just listen to you now. You've had something to say all the way to the end of the run. Gwen glared daggers up at her larger cousin and let out an incoherent growling sound. It was all she could manage as the crew of training guardsmen rounded the corner and pounded their way down the final length of wall to the courtyard. As they ran, people in the market watched them pass. Gwen herself had seen this peculiar practice of the guard on many occasions. She had been aware that she would perforce engage in the same activity upon joining, but no one had told her that it was so very taxing.
Company!
Bellowed the grey-haired Captain Cavallo as they reached their destination.
Halt! Fall out, people!
The grey-clad guardsmen staggered to a ragged stop. Though the new recruits had set off in a neat formation, four abreast, that hadn't lasted long, and the crew that flopped down onto the cinderstone floor did so in an unruly, panting mob. The shapeless tunic and trousers that they'd run in were all identical, and all of them were dampened with sweat. The veterans came to a relaxed stop, their breathing controlled, and stood grinning at the recruits, or else speaking quietly to one another. Gwen disliked being gawked at by absolutely anyone, though that blocky, blonde Reginald Astor annoyed her more than most. He thought himself handsome, and was, in an irritatingly self-assured way, and he always had a habit of staring when she was dishevelled and covered with sweat, with her uniform sticking to her in a most unladylike fashion. She looked up with a scowl and found Reginald staring again, an insolent smile on his face. She glared at him and said to Benedict, "I don't suppose you mentioned to Reggie how much I dislike his gawking." Benedict looked down at her, smiling.
"It would only make him be more obvious about it."
"Such a needless trial," Gwen muttered, "in addition to the needless trial we're already undergoing."
"Would you like me to go protect my helpless little cousin, then?" Benedict offered. Gwen frowned for a moment. Benedict's offer was tempting, and it shouldn't have been. Normally, she would have been perfectly comfortable with the notion of bracing some leering cad and pinning his ears back properly. For some reason, though, allowing her cousin to manage such a thing for her seemed simpler.
Perhaps it was the exhaustion of all the running and classwork.
Cavallo lectured the recruits for several hours every afternoon about the various habils, their laws, and their relationships with one another. And while her own tutors had long since given her a similar grounding, it seemed that they had left a good many things out of their lessons. Or at least, they had never made any particular effort to bring the ramifications of all those dry facts to Gwen's attention. And she had found herself stammering like a perfect nitwit when confronted with them during the captain's lectures. Gwen was unused to being less than excellent at anything she pursued. She was not an excellent runner. She was not an excellent student of spire politics. Nor did she seem to be able to gain a proper grasp of the morning inquisition classes, a subject to which she'd had no prior exposure whatsoever. Oh, she had done well enough in the practice hall, when it came to the use of gauntlets at least, but her blade work remained every bit as inept as it had ever been, and she felt glumly certain that when live blade training commenced in a few weeks, she would continue working with a wooden training blade. Being incompetent was surprisingly draining upon one's confidence, and annoying. Was that why she didn't want to deal with Reginald? Was she afraid that she would find herself insufficient to the task of dissuading him? She'd had a considerable amount of practice in insufficiency of late. What if it had become a habit? Nonsense, she told herself firmly. It appeared that she was going to have to face a great many challenging circumstances if she was to remain a guardsman, and she had to remain a guardsman. Any other outcome was unacceptable, since it would mean returning home and admitting to Mother that she had been correct. Now that was something that could not be borne. "I will deal with him," Gwen said firmly. "But thank you, Cuz, for offering." Benedict nodded as if that had been the answer he expected all along.
"May I recommend you wait for a bit of privacy? A young woman bracing a peer in public is one thing. A recruit who confronts a veteran guardsman that way is another matter entirely."
"I'll consider it," Gwen said.
Benedict did his best not to wince, Gwen could tell, but he didn't try to gainsay her either.
"Very well."
She sat for a time, breathing hard, her legs and feet aching most unpleasantly. It would pass, though. Already she felt she had recovered better from this run than she had after a night's sleep subsequent to her first run 2 weeks before. Gwen had to admit that the exercise was quite practical. Each level of the spire was simply enormous, and if one could maintain a hard pace for hours at a time, it would not be difficult to outrun an enemy or to catch some kind of criminal. Thieves, she felt sure, did not run as a matter of daily training. They wouldn't have someone like Cavallo pushing them. Were they the self-motivated sort, they would hardly be thieves, would they? When Gwen looked up again, most of the recruits and veterans had moved back into the walled courtyard of the Spire Arch's palace. Only Reginald and a handful of his cronies remained outside, along with Gwen and one of the largest young women Gwen had ever met. The girl was a quiet one, and her blonde hair was long and thick.
She had shoulders as wide as some men, thick wrists, and strong-looking hands and forearms. Her name was... Bother. Gwen couldn't remember her introducing herself to anyone. Actually, Gwen couldn't remember her speaking at all, unless questioned by an instructor in the classroom. The other recruits all referred to her as the Cat Girl. The cat in question came scampering out of the courtyard and ran over to the large young woman. It was a ginger-coloured beast, and would have been quite appealing had it not been such a filthy creature. Cats lived in all the crawl spaces and vents and other unsavoury, dank, vermin-infested regions of the spire as a matter of course. One would see cats now and again when moving about the Habbel, but they rarely associated directly with humans. Occasionally a household might be adopted by a cat, or a small group of them, and some businesses found it wise to offer them food in exchange for their services as exterminators. It was a much simpler arrangement than refusing to pay the cats, and then finding one's stores emptied without a trace in the dead of night. She had heard of cats who had been employed as tenders and guardians for young children, but such arrangements were almost always business-oriented. Gwen had never heard of a cat who showed affection. The lithe creature flowed into the cat girl's lap, turning in several circles and rubbing against her as he did. He nuzzled her cheek with his nose and sniffed curiously at her sweaty uniform. The girl absently ran her hands over the cat's fur, and the beast settled down to enjoy the attention. "What I want to know," said one of Reginald's group, "is what precisely that vermin is doing running loose about the manor." "It's quite unnatural," Reginald agreed. He folded his arms and regarded the cat girl speculatively. "It makes one wonder what could motivate a reasonable person to shelter such a pest." At that, the cat girl looked up at Reginald. The large young man gave her his widest smile. "Well, how about it, Bridget, love? What rewards do you reap from having the beast nearby?" The cat girl, that was right, her name was Bridget, something or other, looked at Reginald for a few seconds before answering. Her face was a neutral mask.
"You wouldn't understand."
That drew a round of chortles from the young nobles.
"Really?" Reginald asked. "And why is that?"
Bridget frowned thoughtfully for a moment, choosing her words with deliberate care. Then she nodded, slightly, to herself, and said calmly,
"Because you are an ass, sir."
Had the cat girl slapped him across the face, she could not have drawn a more startled reaction from the young noble. Reginald opened his mouth silently a few times, and then said,
"Excuse me?"
"I'm sorry,"
Bridget said. She rose, still holding the cat in her arms, and raised her voice slightly, enunciating the words.
"You are an ass."
She smiled faintly.
"Sir."
Gwen felt her eyebrows climb toward her hairline.
You cannot speak to me in such a way,"
Reginald said. Bridget and the cat regarded him with unblinking eyes.
"Apparently I can, sir."
Reginald's eyes flashed with anger.
"You shouldn't even be here," he snarled. "Your house died decades ago. You and your father are nothing but the last few scraps of meat clinging to a rotting bone."
Something shifted. Gwen couldn't tell precisely what had happened, but the air was suddenly thick. Bridget's face never moved. Her eyes didn't narrow, nor did she bare her teeth. She said nothing. She did not so much as twitch a muscle. She only stared at Reginald. It was the cat, Gwen realized. The beast's eyes seemed to have grown larger, and the very tip of his long tail had begun to flick left and right in slow rhythm. The cat stared at Reginald as if he were preparing to spring upon him with murder in mind. When Bridget spoke, her voice was hardly louder than a whisper.
What did you say about my father?
Gwen rose hurriedly. Reginald was a practiced duelist, and while most such confrontations ended in only mild injuries, it was quite possible for one or both participants to be killed when tempers were hot, and she was abruptly certain that the heavy silence now gathered around the cat girl was a thundercloud of undiluted rage. An insult like the one Reginald had delivered was ample grounds to demand satisfaction, though she was certain the ass hadn't deliberately set out to provoke the reaction. If, however, Bridget was as upset as Gwen suspected, that might be exactly what he got, and Reggie, for all his oafishness, was more than competent with both blade and gauntlet. Bridget was very nearly as bad with blades as Gwen was, and her gauntlet work was atrocious. A duel could not end well for her.
"Excuse me,"
Gwen said, walking over to Bridget as though nothing at all were happening. Bridget's eyes and those of the cat both flicked toward Gwen at the same time. Goodness, that young woman was tall. She had at least a foot on Gwen.
"We haven't been introduced," Gwen said pleasantly. "I'm Gwendolyn Lancaster."
Bridget frowned faintly.
"Bridget Tarquin."
Gwen cocked an eyebrow.
"The House of Admiral Tarquin."
The corner of Bridget's mouth twitched, perhaps in irritation.
"The same?" "How wonderful,"
Gwen said, a slight edge to her tone.
"He was the finest naval commander in the history of all of Spire Albion. In fact, the Spire might not be here at all if not for his courage and skill. You come from one of the greatest families in our history."
Bridget frowned again, then she ducked her head in a small, awkward bow.
"Thank you."
"She comes of a footnote in Albion history," Reginald said, his voice sullen. "What has her family done for the Spire lately? Nothing. Their house grows meat, for heaven's sake, like a common trog."
Bridget's eyes went back to Reginald.
"You say that as if it is an insult, sir."
"And what is that supposed to mean?" Reginald demanded.
"That I would rather be a common trog than an ass of House Astor, sir."
Reginald's face turned bright red.
"You dare cast an insult into the face of my house?"
"Not its face," Bridget said, arching an eyebrow. "Its ass!"
"You vile little trog!" Reginald said. "You think that because you've been to the Spireark's Manor, because you are in training for the Guard, that you are worthy of such an honour? You think you can yap and taunt your betters because of it?"
"I'm not sure," Bridget said. "I'll let you know once I meet someone better than me."
Reginald's eyes blazed, and with a snarl he ripped one of his gloves from his belt and flung it hard at Bridget's face. Bridget never moved, but Gwen did. She snatched the glove out of the air and turned to face Reginald.
"Reggie, no!"
"Did you hear that bloody slab?" Reginald snarled. "Did you hear what she said about my house?"
"And what you said about hers,"
Gwen said.
"You started this, Reginald Astor."
"Stay out of this, Gwendolyn. I demand satisfaction."
His furious gaze went back to Bridget.
"Unless the famed courage of the House of Tarquin has dwindled away to nothing along with its bloodline."
Bridget's frown deepened and her mouth opened slightly. She glanced aside at Gwen and said,
"Miss Lancaster, did this man just challenge me to a duel?"
"Hardly a man," Gwen replied. She looked up and met Bridget's eyes, and yes, he did.
"Lunatics,"
Bridget breathed.
"Must I accept?"
"If you don't," Gwen said, "he can litigate. The council could assess a punitive fine against House Tarquin."
"Could," Reginald said. "Would. I guarantee the High Houses would rule harshly against such a display of disrespect to one of the leading houses of Albion."
Bridget looked at Gwen again.
"Is that true?"
"Courts are never certain," Gwen said. "It probably is."
"But I never insulted the Astors. Only him."
"'He's the heir to the house, I'm afraid,' Gwen said. "'The council may not make that distinction.'
Bridget closed her eyes for a moment and muttered beneath her breath,
"'When will I learn to keep my mouth shut?'
"'You don't have to do this,'
Gwen said.
"'We are barely holding on as it is,' Bridget said. "'If we were fined, my father would have to sell the battery.'
Reginald barked out a harsh-sounding laugh.
"'Which is why insignificant little nothing houses should show more respect to their seniors. You should have thought of that before you spoke.'
The cat's claws made a scratching sound against the sleeve of Bridget's shirt. She put a hand on the beast, as if restraining it.
"'Apologize,' Reginald snarled. "'Now, and I will forget that this happened.'
Bridget paused again before she spoke. Then she squared her shoulders, faced Reginald, and said,
"'But I wouldn't.'
She glanced at Gwen.
"'How does this work? Do we fight right now?'
Gwen blinked up at the large girl.
"'You actually intend to accept his challenge?'
Bridget nodded her head once. The cat made a low, eager growling sound.
Gwen sighed. "'It doesn't happen here.' You'll need a second, someone to accompany you, help you prepare, and to schedule the duel. You'll also need a marshal to adjudicate it.
Bridget blinked.
That seems like a needlessly complicated way to do something so adolescent. And there are excellent reasons for it,
Gwen said.
I see,
Bridget said.
How do I accept his challenge?
Gwen wordlessly held out the glove.
Ah.
Bridget said, and took it. Reginald nodded tightly and gestured at one of the young nobles beside him.
"'This is Barnabas. He will be my second. Have your second contact him. Good day.'
He spun on a heel and marched away, into the palace, taking his entourage with him. Bridget and Gwen watched them go. After a moment, Bridget said,
"'I didn't need your help.'
"'Pardon?' Gwen asked.
"'Your help! I didn't need you to come over here and make things worse!'
"'Worse?' Gwen asked, startled.
"'In what way did I make things worse? I didn't ask you for your help. When you got involved, his idiot pride was at stake. He was forced to start defending the honour of House Astor for fear of showing weakness to a Lancaster!'
Bridget shook her head.
"'If you weren't there, all I had to do was stop talking.' It would have left him with nowhere to go.
I was trying to help you, Gwen said.
Bridget rolled her eyes.
Why do all you people in the high houses think that you are the only ones who can possibly manage matters that are none of your bloody business? Did you even consider the fact that I might not want your interference?
Gwen folded her arms and scowled.
She hadn't, had she? Not for one second.
And of course Reggie had been more stung by Bridget's words because he wanted Gwen and resented being humiliated in front of her. Gwen hadn't thought things through. She'd simply charged into the situation, attempting to pour oil on troubled waters, only she'd set the oil on fire instead. As a result, it looked like someone was going to get burned. She couldn't leave things in that state, not when she'd helped put them there. She couldn't bear it if anyone were hurt because of her foolishness. Well, perhaps if it was Reggie, and he wasn't hurt too badly, but she'd feel awful if anything happened to Bridget.
"'You might have a point,' Gwen said quietly. "'But that doesn't matter now.'
"'Why on earth not?'
Bridget asked.
"'Haven't you the faintest idea of what is involved in a formal duel?'
"'Two fools,'
Gwen found herself smiling faintly.
"'Other than that,'
Bridget seemed to withdraw into herself. She hunched down a little, as if trying to hide her height. She frowned down at the cat, stroking its fur.
"'Other than that? No. I have no idea.'
"'Reginald does,'
Gwen said quietly.
"'You might not want my help, Miss Targwin, but as of now, you most assuredly need it.'
Chapter 5 Spire, Albion. Habel Morning. Bridget regarded the nobleman uncertainly.
I'm not at all sure about this, sir.
Benedict Sorrelin Lancaster stood facing her, in the gloom of what could only loosely be considered early morning in Habel Morning's marketplace, outside the training compound of the Spire Arch Guard. He was a tall man, as tall as her father, but lean with youth and a natural inclination. Benedict gave her a smile that he probably meant to be reassuring, but it showed a little too much of his larger-than-average canine teeth.
"That's the problem, isn't it?" he said. "You aren't sure, and you need to be. Come on, then. I need to assess what kind of physical strength you have. You'll not hurt me, Miss Tarquin, I assure you."
"It seems improper," she said, frowning.
Of course she wouldn't hurt him, but even had that been her intention, Benedict's golden, vertically slit eyes showed him to be warrior-born, with the blood and the strength of lions in his limbs.
"Are you quite sure this is sanctioned by the guard?"
"Normally, open-hand combat is taught after your initial training course, but there's no regulation that says you've got to wait that long to learn, as long as it's your time you're spending and not the guard's."
"I see," Bridget said. "That seems equitable.
How should I attack you?"
Benedict's face remained serious, but his eyes suddenly sparkled. Bridget's stomach did an odd little shuffle step, and she looked down straight away. "Just come at me," he said. "Try to pick me up." Bridget frowned, but nodded at him.
"I see," she said.
She took several steps closer to the young man and said,
"Excuse me, please."
"Don't say excuse me," Benedict chided. "You won't be saying excuse me to Reggie on the dueling stage."
Bridget bent, fairly irritated by his tone, got a shoulder beneath Benedict's stomach, and dragged him up off the floor. He wasn't much heavier than a slab of red meat from one of the large vats back home, and she lifted him, held him there for a moment, and then continued the motion, tossing him over her back and onto the cinderstone floor behind her. She turned to find him sitting on the ground, staring at her with his mouth slightly open.
"I'm sorry," she said. "Was that acceptable?"
You,
Benedict said. His golden eyes glinted in the gloom.
"You're rather fit, Miss Tarquin."
"I work for a living,"
Bridget said. She regretted the words almost instantly. She hadn't meant them as an insult to him, implying that he did not, but a prickly scion of one of the great houses of Albion could readily interpret them that way. But no anger touched his eyes. Instead, his face spread into a slow, delighted smile.
"Oh, maker of ways," he breathed, and the sound flooded out into a bubbling laugh.
Bridget liked the way his laugh sounded. She found her mouth tugging up into a small smile.
"I beg your pardon, sir?"
"We should issue tickets to this duel," he said. "Reggie could spend his life trying and still not live it down."
"I beg your pardon,"
Bridget repeated.
"Whatever do you mean?"
"The duel," the young man said. "He challenged you, which means that you have the right to choose the location of the duel and the weapons to be used."
"How nice for me," she said, "but I still don't follow."
Benedict pushed himself back up to his feet, smiling.
"You don't choose a weapon at all. You make it an unarmed duel."
Bridget tilted her head.
"That does seem less likely to result in someone being maimed or killed for no good reason. But I don't know how to fight that way."
"I do," Benedict said. "The basics are reasonably simple to learn, and you're strong enough."
Bridget frowned.
"But presumably Reggie has had a great deal more training than I have, and while I am quite strong for a woman, I am surely not much stronger than he is. Would that not mean that he would have little difficulty in overcoming me?"
"That depends on what path you take," Benedict said.
Bridget felt her frown deepen.
"My path? You aren't going to attempt to convert me to your religion, are you? I hope you're not, sir.
That would be awkward.
Again, that easy laugh rolled forth. Those who follow the way have no need to proselytize. One does not convert to the way. One simply realizes that one already follows the way.
God in heaven, not that speech again,
came a new voice. Gwendolyn Lancaster appeared from the gloom, dressed in the plain grey exercise clothing of the guard, just as they were. It was difficult for Bridget to reconcile the absolute confidence in the noblewoman's stance and voice with her utterly diminutive size. Bridget felt quite certain that even without training, she could break Miss Lancaster like a ceramic doll.
"Dearest coz,"
Benedict said, his voice turning even more pleasant.
"You are looking particularly Gwenish today."
Gwendolyn arched one dark brow sharply at that statement, and then said, "What are you doing on the ground?"
"She threw me here," Benedict said, his tone pleased.
Gwendolyn frowned at him, and then her eyebrows lifted.
"Did she?"
Her eyes turned to Bridget. "She doesn't look warrior-born."
"She isn't," Benedict said,
"but she works in a vattery. I don't suppose I weigh too much more than a side of red meat, do I, Miss Bridget?"
"Not much more at all, sir."
Gwen narrowed her eyes.
"Oh, you aren't thinking..."
"For Reggie, I most certainly am," Benedict said. "It's perfect."
"Stop it,"
Bridget said at last, exasperated.
"Both of you, stop it this instant. It's like you've both read a book that I haven't, and you won't stop talking about it. It's most impolite."
"I'm sorry," Gwendolyn said. "I take it you weren't raised to be as underhanded and devious as Benny and me." Bridget blinked. Goodness, that the noble woman would just say it outright like that seemed very, very bold. But at the same time, somewhat reassuring. Gwendolyn Lancaster might have been many things, but at least she didn't seem as smugly capable of self-deception as many of the other children of the high houses.
"I would not care to make such a judgment of your families," Bridget said carefully, "but no, it would seem not."
Raoul came padding out of the darkness, silent, as always, offering no explanation of where he had been, as always. Bridget bent one of her knees slightly, hardly needing to think about it, and he used it as a springboard to hop lightly into her arms, and then flow up onto one of her shoulders. The cat nuzzled her cheek, and she leaned her head in toward his slightly.
"Listen carefully, little mouse,"
Raoul said, in an almost inaudible tone.
"I have sought word upon these two. They are dangerous."
Bridget flicked her eyes toward the cat and gave a tiny fraction of a nod to tell him that she understood. Being called dangerous by a cat could mean a great many things, but it was generally delivered as something of a compliment. She thought the two nobles to be rather self-involved, and entirely overflowing with arrogance they hardly seemed to know existed. But she had learned long ago not to treat a cat's opinion lightly. So she said to Gwendolyn,
"Please excuse me, Miss Lancaster. You were saying?"
Gwendolyn had tilted her head, her bright eyes studying the cat sharply.
"I was saying that if you can come near to matching Reggie in physical strength, then you can fight a duel he cannot win." "I don't really care if anyone wins," Bridget said. "I just want everyone to walk away alive, and for this nonsense to be over."
Gwendolyn blinked and suddenly flashed Bridget a smile that looked as warm and true as an aeronaut's sunrise.
"You have an absolutely wretched attitude about fighting a pointless duel for the sake of pride. Did you know that?" "Thank goodness," Bridget said.
"The point is," Benedict said, rising easily to his feet, "that if you can offer him anything like a real fight, there's no way he can win the duel. If he defeats you barehanded, it likely won't be by much, and he looks like a brute and a bully. And if you defeat him, he'll be forever the Aster who was beaten soundly by..." Benedict broke off and gave Bridget a slight smile.
"By the Vattery Trog,"
Bridget said. She smiled slightly.
That would be quite the vile thing to do to him. Wouldn't it, though?
Gwendolen said, beaming.
But I'm not going to do that,
Bridget said.
Why under heaven would you not?